With her duty passed on, her eyes rolled back. Her fingers slipped free. The neurosurgeon stepped forward. She still needs more rest. Gant ignored him and turned to Painter, still on one knee. His face was forlorn, but his eyes were determined. What must I do to get my grandson back? Painter pictured the video footage shot by Kane's vest camera, showing a mouse's eye view from the bottom of a boat. He had watched it several times over the past half day. The boat chase, the capture, the drugging of Gray Pierce. Each time grateful for the man's ingenuity and sacrifice in securing this secret footage. It offered them a slim chance to turn the tide against the enemy. Painter intended to take it. What do you need me to do? Gant pressed. Painter stared him in the eye and told him the blunt truth. You need to die, Mr. President. Chapter 33. July 4th, 11:34 a.m., Eastern Standard Time, Washington, D.C. Gray rode back into the world on a bolt of lightning. The electric shock burned through his skull, as if someone had shoved the right side of his face against a red-hot stovetop. He gasped, tried to roll away from the pain, but couldn't escape it. The only relief came as the burn faded on its own. Then something bit into the back of his hand. Warmth shot up his arm, into his chest, and ignited his heart. His heart tripped a frantic beat. Blood pressure pounded at his ears. His breathing grew labored for several seconds until the effect wore off. The jolt left him tingling, hyper-alert. The world snapped into sudden sharp focus, still tinged red at the edges. He lay on his back, his pulse throbbing in his throat. As he collected himself, he reached above to touch a concrete roof, so low he could brush his fingertips over its rough surface. He noted a device strapped to his wrist, a syringe locked into a mechanical delivery system. He ripped it off, rolling to the side and holding off the punctured vein. He must have been given a counteragent to his sedative, returning him to full alertness in seconds. But where am I? Concrete walls surrounded him on all sides, creating a box 5 feet wide and 3 feet tall. The illumination was sharp, painfully bright, coming from a battery-powered lamp in the corner. A long metal case rested on the floor near his feet, and one of the walls had a thin aperture sealed by a steel shutter. Even if open, the hole was too narrow to climb through. The only exit appeared to be the hatch in the floor, sealed from the outside. What is going on? The answer came from inside his head, from deep within his right ear. Good morning, Commander Pierce, a mechanized voice greeted him. It sounded like one of those soulless computerized answering services, though he suspected he was hearing a real voice, digitally masked. The rude awakening was a necessity. There was no apologetic tone to that statement, merely matter of fact. The shock and the injection of methylphenidate should have you alert and ready for the task at hand. You have 10 minutes until you must act. To do what? He asked loudly to the bare walls of his concrete crypt. He suspected the answer, glancing at what looked to be a rifle case. The voice continued to speak, either ignoring him or perhaps this conversation was a one-way transmission. The radio deep in your ear is bolted in place and wired via a blasting cap. You'll find that same ear packed full of C4. Disturbed, Gray probed with a finger and discovered a wad of hard material jammed into the canal. He pictured what would happen if that exploded, and quickly pushed that thought away. The speaker continued. The device can also be used as punishment, as you experienced upon waking. Additionally, it's wired to a transmitter held by a guard outside. If you stray beyond 10 yards from that transmitter, you have 10 seconds to get back in range, or the device will automatically explode. They've got me connected to an electric leash. A tingle of foreboding worked through his drug-induced hypervigilance. As to your duty, the voice said. At exactly noon today, you will assassinate President James T. Gant. You will find a sniper rifle and a magazine with 2 rounds in case you miss on your first shot. You will not be given a third chance. Prepare yourself now. The lamp blinked off inside the bunker. A small motorized hum sounded, and the shuttered window opened. Sunlight streamed into the space through the slats. He wasn't blinded. He realized the brightness of the lamp had been to assist him with maintaining his day vision. Gray searched around for a camera while he rolled and crawled to the gun case and snapped it open. Nestled inside was a Marine Corps M40A3 sniper rifle, along with a stabilizing bipod. He slipped the weapon free, checking its heft and balance. He knew this rifle. It had an effective range of 1,000 yards. But what fell within that range? Gray moved into the sunlight's blaze. Staring between the slats, he distantly made out the tip of the Washington Monument poking above a line of towering oaks. I'm back in D.C. He oriented himself. Through the trees, sunlight glinted off water. That had to be the Potomac. Shifting to the left and peering sideways, he caught a peek far to the right of a rolling expanse of green lawns, dogwoods, and rows of small white gravestones. He knew that place too well. He had many friends buried there, Arlington Cemetery. He was north of the park, likely not far from the USMC War Memorial. Closer at hand, viewed down a short street that ended at an oak-studded park, people milled about a large gathering of tents and booths. Most were wearing various shades of armed forces uniforms, from dress blues to camouflage khakis. He raised the rifle and peered through the telescopic sight, adjusting the unertal 10x lens to focus on that gathering. The view zoomed to reveal barbecues, children running and laughing, a military band playing on a shaded stage. The distant beat of drum and sharper notes of brass reached him. In the center of the picnic grounds, a tall platform had been erected, framed by an arch of red, white, and blue balloons. He shifted the sight to maximum, concentrating on the group clustered by the podium. They appeared to be top military brass from every branch of service. Among them, he spotted his supposed target. With his back to Gray, President James T. Gant kissed his wife, who was decked out in a dark blue pantsuit with a muted pink and white striped top and silver flats. It was a festive look for this 4th of July barbecue, a USO celebration. Gray also knew the first couple were hosting a fireworks viewing party on the south lawn of the White House later tonight. But the day's strain already showed on the First Lady's face. The detail through the scope, even at 700 yards, revealed the grief etched in the lines around her eyes, hidden as best she could under thick makeup. Her fingers clung to her husband's hand, trying to hold him as he stepped to the podium. But the president had to show a strong face to the world. The pair both thought their daughter dead, and maybe Amanda was. The last memory Gray had of her was floating in dark waters, supported by his 2 teammates. The administration must not have announced the kidnapping and death of Amanda, likely waiting for confirmation from the charred remains. Probably the White House chief speechwriter already struggled on the wording for that tragic announcement. In the meantime, the parents had to put on a show of normalcy. President Gant stepped to the podium, lifting a hand and waving. A distant cheer rose. Gray turned away, crouching lower in his sniper's nest, resting the rifle across his knees. He picked up the magazine, eyed the cartridges, the newer M118LR rounds, for heightened accuracy. 2 of them. They had better be accurate. He remembered the warning. You will not be given a third chance. But why did his kidnappers believe he would agree to assassinate the president? They had Sechon, but that wasn't enough leverage, as much as it pained him to admit it. He knew they would likely carry out horrible atrocities against her in an attempt to ensure his cooperation, or to punish his failure. That fear sat like a cold stone in his gut. He knew that even to save her, he couldn't sacrifice the leader of the free world. Frustrated, he tightened his fingers on the fiberglass stock of the rifle and on the cold length of deadly muzzle. "I'm sorry, Sechon. I can't do it."
4 minutes,
the voice finally announced, and as if reading his mind, the speaker gave him the incentive to act. "To ensure your cooperation, we have buried 15 plastic cartridges of sarin gas with indetectable triggers throughout the park. The dispersal pattern will sweep the fields, killing everyone there, including the president. Those charges will go off 20 seconds after noon, unless the president is killed first." Gray imagined that wafting nerve gas, so lethal even the briefest skin contact caused an agonizing end. "One death versus hundreds of innocent men, women, and children. The choice is yours, Commander Pierce. Either end will serve our needs, but it serves our purpose better if you pull that trigger. A lone death by assassination will be far more poignant and powerful than one death among many." The coldness of that calculation reached Gray, chilling him. "Also, with your rifle discovered here, as well as your DNA, the assassination will be blamed on the rogue actions of a disgruntled covert operative, one who was retaliating against the mothballing of his group by the administration." In effect, putting the final nail in Sigma's coffin. But the Guild's schemes were even grander than that. "Such an act will require an entire revamping of the United States covert and intelligence agencies. One overseen by us as we take over the White House with the next election. That poignant sympathy for the death of James Gant will extend to his family members, to someone already standing at his side in a position of power." Extend to his family members. Gray felt sick to his stomach. As he listened, armed with his new knowledge, he could now hear the slight southern cadence, the word choice that couldn't be wiped away digitally. His mind raced, picturing the man who stood so steadfastly at his brother's shoulder, whom the world already loved and respected, and would surely hand the reins of power to. The man only had to ask for the White House after such a tragedy, and it would be given to him, in a landslide. The Secretary of State, Robert Lee Gant. Gray squeezed his eyes closed. He suddenly remembered sensing that Painter had been keeping something hidden from him, something about the Guild, about the organization behind his mother's fiery death. Was this that secret? Had Painter suspected the man all along? No wonder the director hadn't wanted anyone in the Gant family to know about Amanda surviving Somalia. He feared word would reach the president's brother. Anger burned at the edges of his dismay. He logically knew why the director had kept such a secret from him. Gray might have taken the man out immediately, jeopardizing everyone around him. And ultimately, the foreknowledge of that traitor in the White House wouldn't have changed Gray's mission objectives. Apparently, such knowledge was need to know only, and Gray wasn't on that list. "Still, you should have told me."
"1 minute," the voice warned. "You will wait for our signal, then fire."
Gray secured the magazine in place and returned to his post at the aperture. Shame and anger burned through him. He didn't know if the voice had been lying about those gas canisters, or if they'd be blown up anyway. Either way, Gray knew he couldn't take that chance. James T. Gant had to die. He stared through the rifle's telescopic scope and lowered the crosshairs to the profile of the president as the man turned to the side. He double-checked his range, 700 yards, and fixed the main targeting chevron of the rifle's sights upon the occipital bone behind the man's left ear, knowing a shot there would do the most damage. Festive music and bright laughter from the holiday picnic filtered to him. He let it all fade into the background as he concentrated on his target, on his mission. In U.S. history, three presidents had died on the exact same day, on July 4th, on the birthday of this country. It seemed beyond mere chance. Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, and James Monroe. Today would mark the 4th. Then the president leaned down, forcing Gray to follow him. The man ruffled the fur of a dog sharing the platform with him. Gray tensed, recognizing that shepherd. Kane. Gray zoomed out to watch James Gant straighten and shake the hand of Captain Tucker Wayne. The man must have recovered his uniform. His dress blues were decorated with the medals and awards from his tours in Afghanistan. It was appropriate that Tucker should be standing there on the dais, a war hero and his dog being thanked by a grateful commander-in-chief. But Gray knew why Tucker and Kane were really there. All the earlier anger at Painter's secrecy dried up, leaving behind only relief and respect. The director must have received the recorded video from Dubai and understood. But what did he want Gray to do? Gray searched the stage. Painter must have put Tucker up there for a reason. The former Army Ranger was not a regular member of Sigma, only a hired hand, so no one was likely to recognize him. But what was the message Painter was trying to send to Gray? Then he knew. It wasn't just Tucker on that stage, but also Kane. Gray shifted his concentration to the dog. The shepherd stood quietly, tail out, nose pointed up. Gray had seen that particular pose a few times before when the dog had found the source of a scent. Kane was pointing, like any good hunting dog. Gray followed his gaze to a red balloon behind the podium, not far from the president's head. Gray fingered the telescopic sight to zero in on that balloon. It twisted in a slight breeze, revealing a small Greek letter in a darker shade of red, barely discernible unless you were looking for it. Sigma. He smiled and made some final adjustments to his weapon. In his ear, he got the order he needed. Fire! Steadying his breath, Commander Gray Pierce pulled the trigger. Chapter 34. July 4th, 12 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, Washington, D.C. No shot was heard. Only the popping of a balloon. Even that noise startled everyone on the podium. Not Tucker. He had been waiting for that signal. He used the distraction to press the button on the transmitter in his pocket. Small squibs, hidden under the president's white polo shirt, exploded. Packets of the president's own blood erupted out of his back in a violent blast and seeped heavily over his heart in front. The First Lady screamed, catching some of the spray on her face. The Secret Service enveloped the president immediately, gathering him up and whisking him off the platform. Tucker got knocked to the side. Kane danced out of the way. Another cordon of agents formed a living shield to protect the fleeing president. More crowded around the First Lady and rushed her in another direction. Tucker tapped his leg, gathered Kane to his side, and rushed after the president's group. Chaos exploded across the picnic grounds, the sudden violence catching everyone off guard. People yelled, kids were hidden under the bodies of protective parents, a barbecue got knocked over, setting fire to a tent. But a majority of those in attendance were military or former service members. Most had probably been under fire. They made room for the flight of their wounded commander-in-chief. Some even added to the body shield to protect the fallen president. The president's entourage reached the parking lot and the motorcade. As planned, the USSS Electronic Countermeasure Suburban, used by the Secret Service to stop any airborne attacks, ejected its arsenal of infrared smoke grenades, creating a thick pall to protect the president in his final flight to the waiting ambulances. In that momentary confusion, a pair of Secret Service agents who were in on the ruse hauled the president into one of the emergency vehicles. Tucker climbed into the back. Kane jumped in after him. The neighboring ambulance erupted with flashing lights and sirens and took off. The WHCA Roadrunner, the mobile command and control vehicle, sent out the false instruction, drawing the rest of the secure package motorcade to follow the decoy. Armored vehicles gave chase, while local law enforcement blocked streets. Staring out a window, Tucker watched an armored presidential limo race through the smoke with additional escorts, bearing to safety the First Lady, who must be beyond distraught, watching her husband shot right in front of her. They needed her to be the grieving wife for the cameras during the next few hours. It was cruel, but no one could know of the subterfuge today, especially the enemy. Amazingly, Painter had orchestrated a deception of this caliber after a single day of planning. He recruited only those he fully trusted, reaching out to a handful of people in various intelligence branches, but mostly he kept this entire operation in-house. One of the Secret Service agents helped the president take off his buttoned polo. Gant wore a pained expression. The reason became clear as his bloody undershirt was stripped off and the exploded remains of the squibs removed. A blistered blast burn decorated the spot under his shoulder blade. "Sir," one of the Secret Service agents started, worried. He was waved away. "I'm fine. Better than a bullet through the head." Another agent started the ambulance and set off, running dark. No flashing lights, no sirens. They headed in the opposite direction from the motorcade. The decoys were racing to George Washington University Hospital, where another team waited to continue the deception. In the story to come, it would be reported that the president was undergoing an extensive emergency surgery to repair his lung, that his chances were poor. They didn't want to risk a second attempt on his life, so they would make it sound bad. But such a ruse could not be maintained for long without the threat of exposure. So they set a 6-hour time limit. 6 hours to bring down a shadowy cabal that had survived centuries. Painter's voice filled one ear. "Report." "The package is secure," Tucker sent back, knowing their voice channel was kept secret by a modified version of the CCEP Type 1 encryption algorithm developed by the NSA to keep presidential communication secret. "What about Commander Pierce?"
"We're working on that right now."
With advanced knowledge of the sniper attack, Painter had set up a ring of tiny high frame rate slow motion cameras around the stage, all fixed on that balloon. Those cameras should have recorded the bullet's passage and allowed immediate processing of the trajectory. A 3-dimensional laser modeling of the park permitted the analysts at Sigma Command to quickly trace the path of that bullet back to its source. They needed Commander Pierce secured as soon as possible, not only for his safety, but also to obtain whatever knowledge he had regarding the moves of the enemy, including the whereabouts of the president's grandson. Tucker felt a pang of regret, unable to escape the guilt of leaving Amanda's child behind. He intended to do whatever he could to correct that mistake. The first step toward that goal, find and secure Gray. Without that man's information, all of this subterfuge would accomplish nothing. Tucker felt a pang of regret, unable to escape the guilt of leaving Amanda's child behind. He intended to do whatever he could to correct that mistake. The first step toward that goal, find and secure Gray. Without that man's information, all of this subterfuge would accomplish nothing. In 6 hours, it would be announced to the world that the president had miraculously survived his surgery, and the thin advantage of the moment would evaporate. He knew Painter didn't expect to uproot the bloodline completely by these actions, but he had one clear goal, the same one as Tucker, to find and recover Amanda's child and expose everyone involved in this current bloody affair. Even with such a defined objective, the odds were exceedingly long, and without Gray, there were no odds. Painter came back on the line. "We have his location, a utility bunker of an office tower, 700 yards away." Tucker sighed in relief. He locked eyes with the president,
We found him, sir.
James Gant nodded, wincing.
We'd better not lose him.
12:01 p.m. Gray watched the hatch fall open. He still held the sniper rifle in his hands. He had witnessed the explosive chaos following his single shot. As he watched, he held his breath, concerned the sarin gas would still be released, killing everyone in the park. When nothing happened, he suspected that threat had been a lie after all. He saw Tucker race off with the president, rushing him to a secure location. He understood the situation immediately. They were faking the president's death. A risky move on the director's part, but Gray understood why that risk had been taken. It spoke volumes about their desperation. They were likely backtracking a trajectory already, looking to find him, hoping he could supply additional information. That was a problem. I don't know anything more than they do. That is, unless Painter was ignorant of Robert Gant's involvement with the Guild. Maybe the director suspected the president's family or inner circle was involved, but he didn't necessarily know who in the administration was the mole. Gray stared down at his hand. He still had one more round. Was it enough to stall? To buy Painter time to find him? A shout rose from the dark hatch.
Leave the rifle! Show your hands!
Where are you taking me? He called back, both stalling and trying to get more information. The answer came as a shock. Literally. An electrical jolt burst from his ear, blinding him, triggering his jaw to seize, his knees to buckle, sprawling him flat.
Leave the rifle, the guard repeated. Show your hands.
Gray belly crawled and thrust his arms over the open hatch. He breathed heavily, gasping.
Now climb down the service ladder.
Gray dawdled, not because it hurt to move, but to slow things down. He swung his legs into the opening, fumbling with a toe to find the first rung.
You were warned, the guard said.
Gray braced for another shock, but instead a mechanical countdown whispered from his implanted earpiece, arising from the unit itself.
10, 9, 8.
It was the timer for the implanted C4 bomb in his right ear. Whoever held the transmitter must have stepped beyond his 10-yard limit. They were forcing him to follow, tugging at his electric leash. He had no choice but to obey. He picked at that packed ear, knowing it wouldn't do Sigma any good to have half his skull blown away. He had to stay alive, to do his best to learn more, which meant he had to work fast.
7, 6, 5.
Once done, he ignored the ladder's rungs and slid down the frame instead. His feet hit the floor of a concrete corridor as the countdown reached 3. Then thankfully stopped. A circle of soldiers, all in black, surrounded him, weapons in hand. One dashed back up the ladder wearing latex gloves and searched the concrete roost.
Rifles there and some blood for a DNA trace, the man reported and clambered back down.
He held the syringe injection system in one hand and bagged it away, cleaning up any evidence.
All clear.
The team leader stepped up, a head taller than the others, with a crucifix-shaped tattoo on his neck. He pocketed a device the size of a packet of gum. The transmitter.
Move out, he ordered.
Pistols encouraged Gray forward, down a set of stairs to a sub-basement, then through a hidden door into a tunnel system. Gray stared behind him as the door sealed, hoping his plan worked. As his feet dragged, the countdown began again in his ear.
10, 9, 8.
Like a dog on a leash, Gray hurried forward obediently. For now. 12:32 p.m.
Report, Painter said,
standing in the communications nest at Sigma headquarters.
We arrived on site, his unit commander reported from the field. Found the bunker empty. No sign of Commander Pierce, only a sniper rifle and several drops of blood.
Painter closed his eyes and fought against the tide of despair at losing Gray's trail. He turned his mind instead to what was left behind. A rifle and blood. Painter understood. They were planning on pinning the assassination on Gray, and in turn destroying Sigma's reputation. But like in any chess match, it was now Painter's turn. "Grab the rifle and bring it here," he ordered. "Destroy the blood evidence and scour the place clean. But you'll need to be quick." In the aftermath of the attack, chaos still reigned, but it wouldn't be long before forensic teams discovered the sniper's hiding place. His team needed to be finished by then, but he refused to let panic distract his focus. Neither would Gray. "Before you start cleaning," Painter warned over the radio, "thoroughly search every square inch of that space. If I know Gray, he would try to leave us some clue."
"Understood."
Painter ended the conversation and spoke to Jason Carter, who stood in the doorway to Cat's office.
"Hold down the fort here. Let me know if anything goes wrong."
Like it hadn't already.
"I've got things covered," Jason assured him.
Painter hurried out the door and down the stairs, headed for the lowermost floor. President James Gant was already down there with his daughter. The man had arrived in secret a few minutes ago. The Smithsonian castle had been closed all day, specifically for this purpose. No one paid attention to the shuffle of the janitorial staff into the building. No one saw them enter the special elevator that led down to the command bunkers of Sigma. For now, everyone believed the president was undergoing emergency surgery at George Washington University Hospital, that the likelihood of his survival was extremely poor. Painter had his communications nest monitoring events, making sure the deception remained in place, massaging the press where needed. But such a level of fraud couldn't last forever without risking exposure. In less than 6 hours, it would have to end. Knowing time was ticking down, Painter returned to the hospital ward. 2 Secret Service agents protected the hall, another manned a post by the elevator. The 4th guard stood inside the small ward. Painter found Gant sitting on the edge of Amanda's bed, holding her hand. He had stripped out of the janitorial coveralls and wore wrinkled navy blue slacks and a borrowed gray shirt. Amanda still balanced between moments of lucidity and sedation, monitored by her neurologist, who remained concerned about the subdural hematoma. At the moment, she slept. Gant looked up as he entered. "She spoke a few words when I came in. She's still worried about her baby."
"We all are,"
he nodded.
"What's the word from your field team? Did they find your man?"
Painter hated to dash the gleam of hope in a father's eyes, but he'd had enough deception for one day.
"Already gone. But I'm hoping he left some clue behind. We should know in a few minutes."
Gant sighed, turning to his daughter. He spoke slowly, full of regret. "I pulled her into the limelight and made her childhood a spectacle, a target for the press. And I still had no time for her. No wonder she rebelled, lashed out. No wonder she fled without saying a word. What trust have I earned in her life?" He glanced up, wiping a tear, but never let go of her hand. "I promised her I'd find William. Don't make me let her down again." Painter stepped over and placed a hand on his shoulder, silently making an oath to do everything he could to help. "What they did to her...
to my family?" Gant said.
"If I ever find out who orchestrated this, who tortured my baby girl, I will make them regret it for the rest of their days. There will be no quick death. I will make them suffer like no other. I'll turn their world into a personal hell on earth." Painter knew that if anyone had the power to do that, it was President James Gant. A commotion drew both their attentions around. Jason came flying into the room, winded.
"Director!"
The young man never stopped moving, continuing past the end of the bed and toward the neighboring medical office.
"Linus just got a hit."
Painter got drawn into the wake of his excitement. It took him an extra moment to remember that Linus was Jason's partner in that vehicle identification program. Hope flared inside him. Have they found something? He rushed after Jason into the medical office. The kid was already at the computer, typing fast. What is it? Painter asked. The president stood in the doorway too, listening in. I'll show you, Jason said, typing as he spoke. That's why I came running down here. Linus had been checking all the major thoroughfares leaving Charleston, searching for any further hits on that Ford. The problem is that the farther you get out from the city, the more variables come into play. So many different roads that could be taken, spreading wider and wider like the branches on a tree. What did you find? Painter pressed. This, Jason pointed at the screen. A clear photo of the front end of a Ford Explorer appeared. Pick this up from a security camera at a drawbridge outside of Orangeburg, South Carolina. Through the windshield, Painter spotted Lisa behind the wheel. His breathing grew heavier, both relieved and terrified. A man sat next to her, his arms awkwardly raised behind him, like he was stretching. Or maybe his hands were bound behind him. You found her, Painter mumbled. How long ago was this taken? Jason looked both apologetic and worried. 2 days ago. The same day Dr. Cummings was kidnapped in Charleston. The president spoke at the doorway. Who is Dr. Cummings? She's everything to me. Aloud, Painter replied, she was one of the operatives sent to investigate the North Charleston Fertility Clinic. Gant's face grew grim, likely remembering the footage he'd been shown, of women floating in gel-filled tanks. Jason drew their attention back to the original still shot and pointed. This is what got me so excited. Painter leaned closer. A license plate. Clear as day. I have Linus running a trace on the car's GPS to find out where it might be. We should... A dialogue box popped onto the screen. I think this is it. Jason tapped on the hyperlink in the box. The image of the Ford vanished, replaced by a map view. A blinking blue circle narrowed and zoomed, shrinking down toward the border, where a corner of South Carolina pushed between Georgia and North Carolina. The circle finally changed into a small triangle, positioned deep into the Blue Ridge Mountains. The president was drawn by the activity. Can you zoom in and get a street address? Painter asked Jason. It was Gant that answered. No need. I know where that is. That's within my family's estate, Fleury-la-Montagne. Before Painter could react, his cell phone vibrated. He answered it and was patched through to the unit commander in Arlington. Director, we found something here. Painter's heart, already beating hard, sped faster. What? I took a photo. I've already dispatched it to you. Painter ordered Jason to retrieve it. The commander explained while they waited. We found it scrawled on the floor near the entrance hatch. Mostly invisible to the naked eye, but it glowed under an ultraviolet scan of the chamber. I think it was written with a smear of C4. Plastic explosive? Yes, sir. I scraped up a tiny dab with a toothpick. From the feel, from the chemical taste, I believe so. Jason interrupted. I've got the photo. It appeared in the top corner of the monitor. Three letters glowed with a soft phosphorescence against the dark concrete. RLG. RLG. Painter mumbled aloud. What does that mean? Again, it was the president who answered, his voice pale with shock. Those are my brother's initials, Robert Lee Gant. Painter twisted to face him. They both knew some of Gant's family members had to be involved with this mess, but neither of them suspected anyone this close to the first family. Gant stared over at his daughter, likely thinking the same. Only for him, this dagger dug much deeper and straight into his heart. We can't be sure about your brother, Painter offered. I can, Gant said faintly. How? Gant pointed to the lower part of the computer screen. It still displayed the GPS map. Bobby was headed to the family estate for the holiday, to avoid the 4th of July crowds in D.C. He left 2 days ago to do some hunting. To Fleury-la-Montagne? Gant looked drawn and pale, his voice grim. No one really uses that French name any longer. Everyone just calls it the Lodge. Chapter 35. July 4th, 1:04 p.m., Eastern Standard Time, Blue Ridge Mountains. His color's good, Lisa pronounced. She stood before the neonatal incubator. Her gloved hands gently rolled the newborn onto his side, and she listened to the back of his thin chest with her stethoscope. His heartbeat was as rapid as a bird's, but strong. His pulse ox readings normal. She let him roll back on his own. Huge blue eyes, framed by a hint of eyelashes, ogled up at her, his lips pursed hungrily. Edward Blake stood at her shoulder, watching her examination. Petra was off in another lab, running the latest DNA analyses, using samples of the boy's blood and skin, along with cells gathered from a mucosal swab. We should get another bottle. Lisa snapped off her gloves. He's been suckling well on his own since we took out his NG tube and PICC line. Let's keep him moving in that right direction. But all in all, he's rallying beautifully. That's all because of you, Dr. Cummings, Edward said. It wasn't false praise. Yesterday she had found the child circling the drain. She had spent a full hour studying his labs, his radiographs, even his genetic analyses. She had stared with amazement at the triple helix formations on an electron micrograph, two natural DNA strands wrapped around an engineered foreign protein, PNA, peptide nucleic acid. That little microscopic strand of PNA was the source of so much misery, horror, and abuse. And it wasn't doing the boy any good either. Edward had explained about the unraveling going on in the boy's body, how these triple helix compounds were breaking down. But the question still in the air was, why? Did the boy get sick, and that started to unravel the helices? Or did the unraveling make the boy sick? The only way to know for sure was to stabilize the child and see if the unraveling stopped on its own. Lisa had come up with a suggestion, after noting the slight spike in eosinophil levels in the boy's lab work. Eosinophils were the white blood cells that modulated allergic inflammatory processes. They also reacted to parasitic infections, but stool tests had already ruled out that possibility. The more likely source for his allergic response was the PNA strands. Peptic nucleic acid was a protein like any other, capable of being an allergen as surely as dust or dander. With the breakdown of the triple helices, the freed PNA was being washed out into the cytoplasm, then shed free of the cells. Petra had shown her a picture of a worm-like PNA molecule squiggling out of an intestinal cell. This rush of engineered protein into the bloodstream and interstitial tissues triggered the mobilization of eosinophils, the body's defense against such foreign invaders. This allergic anaphylaxis tipped the child into shock. Recognizing this threat, Lisa had recommended a low-dose therapy of antihistamines and intravenous steroids to knock down that allergic response, to give the child's body a chance to flush out the foreign allergen and stabilize again. It worked out beautifully. She had kept a post beside the neonatal incubator all night, assisted by Edward as needed, and hour by hour, the child improved. They were able to slowly unhook him from fluids, oxygen supplementation, and even the feeding tube. Only one question remained. Did it do any good? Did the boy's rallying health succeed in returning stability to the triple helices? She knew that was Edward's hope. They both awaited Petra's answer. As Lisa fed the child with a bottle, Edward retired to a computer workstation in a neighboring cubicle. Both lost to their own worries. Concern for the child's well-being had staved off her terror for the past day, gave her something to focus on. She knew Kat was somewhere in this lab complex, but where was her friend holed up? For that matter, where was this lab? So far, both Petra and Edward had treated her with a modicum of respect, appreciating and needing her help. She remembered those digitized words, a cold warning, "Prove your usefulness, and you both continue to live." With the child doing better, Lisa's usefulness was about to come to an end. Then what? She remembered who had assigned her to this job in the first place, picturing his kind face, his soft words. "Thank you, Dr. Cummings, for agreeing to help my grandnephew." Anger raged inside her against that cool, calm demeanor of Robert Gant. She knew how much pain and suffering and loss it cost to bring this special child into existence, to this place and time. Still, she couldn't blame the child for such atrocities. The boy might have been born out of blood and heartbreak, but he was still an innocent. The child finished suckling, the bottle empty. Those big eyes drooped, heavy with milk-sodden drowsiness. Lisa let him drift into slumber, oblivious to the horrors beyond the clear plastic walls of his incubator. She turned to Edward and limped over to him, favoring her aching ankle. Up on the wall, a camera tracked her path, swiveling to follow her. She wondered if Robert Gant watched her or merely some bored guard. Exhausted, Lisa was beyond subtlety or subterfuge. "Edward, what are you trying to accomplish with these triple helices?" He swung around on his desk chair. "Ah, I can't speak to the goal of my financial benefactors. All I know is my purpose in the grand scheme of things." "And that's what?" He raised an eyebrow, belying the hubris that followed. "To forge the key to life itself." He gave her a tired smile, and surprisingly, she echoed it. "As lofty as that might sound, PNA is that key," Edward explained. "It unlocks the full power of DNA and places the blueprints of life into our hands. With PNA, genomics experts can engineer strands that can turn specific genes on or off, unfettering mankind from its biological limitations. But it also allows new genes to be introduced, new code written onto the PNA and inserted into a fertilized egg. In the end, God will no longer evolve man. We will." Edward stared toward the child in the incubator. "But all that will come later. For the moment, we have only one goal engineered into this first strain of PNA. A simple thing, really." Lisa felt a sick turn to her stomach. "What goal?" Edward's eyes never left the sleeping boy, the doctor's expression a mask of wonder and also sadness. "Immortality." Lisa couldn't hide her shock. "Do not be so surprised, Dr. Cummings. This child is not the first immortal born into this world." Edward finally turned to her, letting her see his sincerity. "They walk among us already." 1:07 p.m., Washington, D.C. 5 hours left. Painter had returned to his own office, leaving the president with his daughter below, guarded by his Secret Service contingent. They were under the five-hour mark until James Gant would come out of hiding and pretend to be recovering from major surgery. Everything to maintain that ruse was already in place. He found Kowalski sitting inside, his feet propped up on Painter's desk, his arms folded over his belly, snoring. Painter shoved his legs off. The man snorted awake. "Are we ready?" he asked. "As we're ever going to be." Painter grabbed a holstered Sig Sauer from a cabinet. The rest of the strike team's gear was waiting at the airstrip, a jet warming up. As he secured the shoulder harness and holster in place, his eyes caught on the picture of Lisa on his desk, smiling softly, hair glowing in the summer sun, lips parted softly. His love for her was a tangible thing, not a thought or a feeling, but a weight in his heart, a pressure in his chest, a stirring of heat in his veins. At that moment, he knew the truth.
I need to buy a ring. Motion at the door drew his attention. Tucker stood there, shadowed by Kane. Painter gave his holster harness a final tug, cinching it snugly, and faced the man. Captain Wayne? Tucker stepped inside.
Sir?
I'd like to join you on this mission. I appreciate that, Captain, but we hired you to find Amanda. Your obligation to us has been fulfilled.
Understood, sir.
Tucker's countenance remained hard, rocky. But not my obligation to Amanda. I left her baby back in Dubai, and I want a chance to correct that mistake. We can certainly use the additional manpower, not to mention your dog's nose, but we'll be parachuting onto the Gant estate. Airspace above the presidential estate was restricted. The no-fly zone had been established before James Gant was president, going back decades, a courtesy of the state of South Carolina for the largesse of the Klan. Painter's plan was to sweep in close, parachute out, and glide low onto the grounds. And those grounds were huge, over 300,000 acres, almost 500 square miles of misty mountains, towering waterfalls, dark forests, and grassy meadows. The estate had ill-defined borders as the family bought neighboring farms, ranches, and orchards, extending their property in fits and starts. That remote, rough terrain would serve to hide them, allowing them to hoof it overland from their drop point. Tucker seemed to have no problem with parachuting onto the estate. Kane and I have had plenty of jump time, the man assured him. I have my dog's harness system with me. Then welcome aboard. Kowalski stood, stretched, and headed out the door with the others. This place is really going to the dogs. Painter set off down the hall. He had been expecting another teammate to arrive by now, but the latecomer would have to meet them at the airstrip. Time was ticking down. Jason Carter would take command at the communications nest in his absence and coordinate efforts from here. It was a lot to place on his young shoulders, but Painter knew he could handle it. Jason had already gathered his own intelligence team in preparation, ruling the nest of older agents with an enthusiasm reserved for the young. Painter reached the elevators as the doors opened. Inside the cage stood the last member of their strike team. Cat's husband adjusted his new prosthetic hand, securing the cuff with a twist and wiggling his fingers. Monk must have already stopped by R&D to get the upgrade Painter had ordered for him, a prosthetic specifically designed for this mission, to help with the infiltration of the lodge. About time, Painter said. Monk glanced up, meeting his gaze, his face fierce.
You try to find a babysitter on the 4th of July. Now let's go get our women.
1:25 p.m. Blue Ridge Mountains.
And you're claiming this child can live forever? Lisa asked. That he's immortal?
Edward continued to sit in his cubicle in the medical ward.
Barring accidents or disease, yes. He could live a very long time. I imagine it will take further tinkering to achieve true immortality. But in the end, like I said, he's not the first immortal born to this world.
What do you mean?
Since we have time until Petra finishes her evaluation of the boy's genetics, I'll do my best to explain. It's the least I can offer you for saving the child.
Lisa was prepared to listen.
Many scientists across a scope of professions believe immortality will be achieved in our lifetime. The dates bandied about all seem to center around the middle of this century, 2045 or so. That means children born today will live to see those accomplishments come to fruition. They will take advantage of them during their lifetimes, becoming immortal. So in that regard, they are immortal already. Or at least something quite close to it. Their lifetimes could be easily doubled or tripled. She imagined what he envisioned. How some children born today will live forever. They were the immortals walking among us already. Still, such a claim seemed impossible. She voiced it aloud. You truly expect we can attain immortality in such a short time frame?
Or something very close to it. And it's not just me making that claim. It comes from hundreds of scientists, researchers, and visionaries across a gamut of professions. From medicine, genomics, and gerontology to pharmaceuticals, nanotech, and robotics. What we're doing in our labs here, financed by our benefactor, is taking the first tentative steps into eternity. Lisa pictured the man orchestrating this work. Our benefactor. Robert Gant. It was beyond comprehension. All this horror perpetrated in an attempt to live forever. Still, Lisa sensed something more was going on. Another agenda still being kept secret. But what? She knew any true answers lay in keeping Edward talking. He obliged, waxing proudly on where the world was heading. There are two general schools of thought in regards to expanding man's lifetimes. The first is moving machines into man. The other is moving man into machines. She shook her head, not appreciating the distinction. 1,000 years ago, the average life expectancy of mankind was only 25 years. It took another 900 years to extend that to 37. Today, the average is 78. So in the past 100 years, we extended life expectancy by over 40 years. That amazing spurt of growth happened because of science and technology, and it will only grow faster from here. Estimates say we will soon be adding a year to our lives with every passing year. Just think about that. For every year you grow older, life expectancy will extend a year in front of you. But what will drive that growth? What has always driven it? The furnace of technology. In that forge, machine and man will melt together into one. He must have read her skepticism and smiled, ready to defend it. Already, people have artificial pancreases inside them, he continued. Currently, 30,000 Parkinson patients have neural implants, and as technology grows smaller, it will invade us even more. Advancements in nanotechnology, which is manufacturing at the atomic level, hold the promise of replacing vital organs in 15 years, our blood cells in 20 years, and in 25 years, nanotechnology will reprogram our biological software to reverse aging. Lisa understood. Moving machines into man, into our bodies. That's one path to immortality. But the reverse holds even greater promise. As computing power explodes exponentially, a term was coined, singularity, marking that moment when artificial intelligence will surpass mankind. Various futurists expect this to occur somewhere in the middle of this century. So soon? Lisa asked. Edward nodded with a small smile of satisfaction. By 2030, estimates say computing power will be 1,000,000 times what it is today. Anything is possible with that much power. In the meantime, scientists from around the globe are searching for methods to merge that growing computing power to our own. In Switzerland, researchers are reverse engineering the human brain, creating a neuron-by-neuron simulation with the intent to have a complete virtual brain in 10 years. Here in the States, a group of MIT researchers are building a map of all the brain synapses, those trillions of connections between neurons, all in search for the seat of human consciousness. Lisa sighed. And I assume that the ultimate goal is to fill that empty seat, to scan our consciousness into computers. Exactly. Moving man into machines. That second path to immortality. Edward glanced over to the incubator. But I'm searching for a third path. Which is what? A new science. Cybergenetics. The merging of technology into our genetic code. The PNA strand, Lisa said, understanding, growing both awed and horrified, picturing that piece of engineered protein snaking into human DNA and regulating it. DNA is really just a set of information processes for building our bodies.
But that software is old. Millions of years old. PNA holds the potential for overhauling that system, rebooting mankind forever. Lisa tried to draw him back down from the lofty heights of theory to the reality of his lab. But back to your own research. What does your PNA do? The one inside the boy.
It basically addresses the deleterious effects that come with growing old. The field of gerontology, the study of aging, has discovered that there are only 7 basic ways a body damages itself as it ages. Reverse those 7 deadly sins, and immortality is within reach.
Edward looked significantly toward her, lifting an eyebrow. You did it, she said in a hushed voice. Your PNA manipulates and regulates the DNA to offset those 7 deadly sins.
It does, but not perfectly. We concentrated most of our efforts on 1 of those sins, the death of cells. Are you familiar with the Hayflick limit?
She shook her head, finding it harder and harder to speak. Back in 1961, Dr. Leonard Hayflick estimated that the maximum natural age for a human being is about 120 years. He based that on the number of times a cell will divide before it stops. The number of these divisions is determined by the length of some repeated DNA at the end of each cell's chromosomes. These repeated sequences are called telomeres. They basically act like the aglets at the end of shoelaces, keeping the laces from fraying. But after a certain number of divisions, the telomeres wear off, and the chromosome frays itself to death. What does that have to do with your PNA?
We engineered the PNA to function as permanent telomeres, in order to create undying cells, and thus allow us to shatter through the Hayflick limit.
Creating a path to immortality.
He nodded. We are at the very threshold to eternity.
But why do this? There are so many negative effects if a man could live forever. Overpopulation, starvation, stagnation. There's a reason we're meant to die, to step aside for the next generation.
True, but those dangers can only exist if the technology is available to all. In the hands of an elite, a chosen people, there would be no such risks.
Shocked, she pictured Robert Gant's face. Was that his plan? To keep his bloodline alive forever? To create an undying dynasty?
Why are you helping them? She finally eked out.
Because I must.
Mankind has always chafed against restraints and limitations. We left our homelands to cross uncharted seas. We broke the bounds of gravity to fly. We even left our planet. Here is merely the next step toward freedom, the ultimate freedom, to break the chains of mortality and free us from our very graves.
Lisa found herself aghast. She had warmed to the man over the past day, working alongside him, but now she saw the chinks in his armor, allowing the madness inside to shine forth. The visionary, Raymond Kurzweil, once posed the question, "Does God exist?"
Edward turned to stare at the boy in the incubator.
His answer was only 2 words. Not yet.
She stared at the man, seeing the glaze of megalomania. She knew from her years in the medical profession that this affliction seldom presented itself as a raving lunacy. Instead, most of those afflicted were charming in demeanor,